Okay, so Perikei. So we Perik Dalet, we talked about Shlomo's internal bureaucracy and his cabinet and his tax collection. And we'd started Perikei, but just to go over the beginning of Perikei again. So in addition to his reign within the Jewish people, Perikei tells us Shlomo haya moshel b'chol ma'amachov v'na'an ha'aretz plishtim v'agvul mitzrayim magishim v'nchavov dimet Shlomo kol yimei chayav. That in addition, his rule extended from the Euphrates, so you know the whole Fertile Crescent, the whole Mesopotamian area, until Mitzrayim, and they would bring tribute to him, and they would work. They were subject to Shlomo, and so he has peace and he has dominion over that whole area. Vahi lechem Shlomo yom echad shloshim kor solet v'shishim kor kamach, and then he had so many workers and so many members of his government, and they all ate, you know, in the whatever, not in the palace, in the palaces, whatever it is exactly, right? I mean, whatever in the seat of the government. So the bread is 30 kor of fine flour and 60 kor of not fine flour. Which I was listening to Ashir yesterday. It's something like 7 tons or something of flour, and then 15
seven
tons.
Tons.
It's like seven and a half tons, and then of fine flour and 15 tons of, inordinate amounts of flour. I didn't sit down and do the math. I have to sit down and do the math. But in addition to that, it was a sarava karbriim. And then it was 10 fattened oxen and 20 pasture-fed oxen, 100 sheep and goats, and then, you know, random deer and gazelles and roebucks and fatted geese.
They were for sure not vegetarian.
No, not at all. Like, there's a fancy meat, you know, it's a tremendous amount of food because there's a lot of people there. Why? So the Tzadki who wrote that bechol ever anahar mitivsach ve'araza bechol machayever anahar v'shalom ayalom mikol avarav mizaviv, because he rules everybody from Tifsach to Azah, and he had peace everywhere. So he has all these people now. Tifsach to Azah. So the Gemara has a machloket. The clear meaning of it is that he controlled like the world. Tifsach and Azah are either on one side of the world and the other, and it just means he ruled the whole world, or they're next to each other, and it's just saying
on the other side.
Right, so that's how I always understood it. But the Gemara says it's just that, just like they own this, he owns everything. But yeah, it could just be that it's a circle, you know. He owns the globe. That's the point. So Vayeshev Yudav Yisrael Lavetach Ish Tachet Gafno V'Tachet Teina Tov Midan Vad Ber Sheva Kol Yemei Shlomo, and everyone is in peace under their fig tree and their grape tree, and everything is good from Dan to Ber Sheva, the whole days of Shlomo. Vahi L'Shlomo Arbeim Elef. And he had 40,000 stalls of horses for his chariots and 12,000 horsemen. So he also has this huge standing army. There's a bit of a problem because here... Well, that's... I'll get to the big problem in a minute. The small, tiny problem here is just the number, is that it says 40,000 here. In Divrei Hayamim it says 4,000.
Everything seems a little bit exaggerated, no?
Yeah, so either it's exaggeration. Chazal say it's either, you know, 40,000 stalls with 4,000 horses, or 4,000 stalls with 40,000 horses, whatever it is, it's millions of horses. The bigger problem is what Charlie notes, is that, and you can only really see it if you look at the next three prakim quickly, is here he has this, his 40,000 horses, or stalls of horses, so God knows how many horses he has. And he only has 12,000 horsemen. Now, Chazal note that there's a prohibition in the Torah. There are three limitations that a king can have. He can't have too many horses. He can't have too much money, and he can't have too many wives. And the way the Gemara understands too many horses, because it's sort of an ambiguous phrase, what does it mean too many horses? So the Gemara assumes too many horses means more than you need for your army. You know, like you can have for your army maybe some extras as backup. But here he has 12,000 horsemen, which means he has enough for 12,000 standing, you know, chariots, which is like the tanks of that day. And he has 40,000 stalls of horses. Right? Even if he only had one horse per stall, he has 28,000 extra.
But didn't they have carriage all?
Right, so enough to ride
six horses per
six horses and things like
or whatever. That. Even if it was that, it's 40,000 stalls of horses. So you know, so how many do you put in a stall? If you put, I don't know, even if you don't take Chazal's numbers, I don't know if it's 10. So if you have 400,000 horses, even if you need six for every chariot, which I don't know if I think it's just one, but even if you need it for carriages or whatever, still you're talking excesses of hundreds of thousands of horses. So he clearly violates that. We know that later on he has a thousand wives, right? Which Chazal understand the maximum to be 18, you know. But would it, you know, it's and his wealth also, as you know, as we'll see, has the amount of gold and
but
everything
God,
he has.
God granted him the wealth,
for sure. But he, you know, these, you know, he. So the way the way Chazal sort of summarized Shlomo's life is. The Gemara in Sanhedrin Chaf Aleph says the reason that the Torah doesn't give the reason for the mitzvot is because, look, one time it did. It said, don't have too many wives, it might lead them astray. And don't have too many horses, because you might end up going to Mitzrayim. And Shlomo looked at it and said, hey, I'm the smartest person who ever lived. I'll be fine, I won't be led astray. So he said, well, I understand the reason. If I understand the reason, I know it doesn't apply to me. They don't have to keep the mitzvah. So he married 1,000 wives. He kept this huge standing army. He has all this money. And that led to his downfall. The wives led him astray. The heavy taxation to get his treasury leads the nation to hate him. He ends up marrying Bat Paro. So he's strayed down in Mitzrayim. And everything collapses. And that, you know, is a summary of Shlomo's life. Yeah, it's...
But God told him, because he didn't ask for wealth, I'll give you.
Oh, for sure. But there's wealth, and then there's, you know, accumulating wealth for the heck of it.
God tells him, I'll make you the richest man of the world. So what's the measure?
That's always the problem, right? I mean, obviously, where's the number end? I don't know. But wherever it was, he clearly... Even if you didn't pass in like Chazal, right? Because there's two positions in Chazal. 18 wives total or 18 wives unless they lead you astray, right? Whatever, but 1,000, right? Somewhere between 18, you know, it means Muzam. And
does Tanakh mention Elef or no?
What? Yeah. Perek Yud Aleph. He has...
Okay.
Yeah, this is even... Yes. Again, even if you think... Right, even if you think that the psukim exaggerated, because you know that is one way of understanding numbers in Tanakh. Still, 1,000 doesn't mean 20. Right, 1,000 might mean 300. You know, but it says 300. It's Perek Yud Aleph pasuk Gimel. Vayilu nashim sarot shamayot pilakshim shlosh meah. Right, 700 wives and 300 and 300 concubines. So again, even if it's exaggerated, which you know numbers in Tanakh sometimes are.
But why is Tanakh sometimes exaggerated? Like
I talked to that once with a professor in YU. Who he just knows that was it's not just Tanakh. It's like in the ancient world that was how numbers were counted. Like you read texts and basically the way that you told narratives was the key the central point of the narrative had to stay the same, and then it was just poetic. The way we use metaphor, they used numbers, right? Like instead of saying. You know, the way people use a zillion, right? They make up numbers that don't exist to explain a lot. So in Tanakh, they said, you know, and you see it in the Gemara also. The Gemara, whenever it wants to say a far distance, always says 400 parsa, right? It's not like they come up with different big numbers. It's always like the same big numbers. 400 is always the number. There's certain numbers that they just use. And, you know, and especially when you see a round number. You know, when you don't see round numbers... They're probably not rounding. But when you see a nice round number, there's always the possibility that, you know, 1,000 is, you know, it's a round number. That's, you know. But I don't know. But even if it's not, you know, the Gemara is capturing that Shlomo has, you know, all the three things that a king is not supposed to do, he is. Yeah. So v'chilkulu anitzavim eilad amelech. Now, where did he get all this money? So that was Perek Dalet. Chilkulu anitzavim eilad amelech. Shlomo bet kol hakarev el shulchan amelech. Shlomo ish chadsho v'lo yadru davar. It was the money from these taxes that paid for this monstrosity of a feast. And they also would deliver barley and straw for the horses, etc. Okay. And now... And this is sort of a fun, this is a very fun literary move by the sefer. Vaitein Elohim chokhma leShlomo tvuna harbe maod virochav lev kachol asher al sfat hayam. And kachol al sfat hayam is the Jews, but also his wisdom is wide and like kachol hayam. Now, what exactly is the difference between chokhma and tvuna? It may be, you know, knowledge and wisdom, you know, and insight or know how. I'm a farshim divided later, but whatever it is, he's brilliant, and it can't be accidental, right? He's given, he asked for wisdom in order to be able to judge the Jews who were nidmeh kachol hayam. So Hashem says, I'll give you the wisdom you need. Your wisdom will be as expansive as kachol hayam to judge the people who are kachol hayam, which is, I assume, what the sort of the illusion is there. Vatir chokhmat Shlomo, mechachmat kol b'nei kedem, umikol chokhmat Mitzrayim, and his wisdom is greater than all of those in the east, and all of Mitzrayim. Vayichkam mikol ha'adam, and we've already discussed a little bit whether he was the smartest ever, or the smartest like in remembered history, but vayichkam mikol ha'adam, ve'eitan ezrachi, ve'eman, ve'chalkol, ve'dardab, b'nei mechol, ve'yushmo b'chol ha'goyim misaviv, and he's smarter than all of these people, which either were known people in that time. The Midrash says, actually identifies, midrashically who these people were. And they don't say, it's not just people in that time. And it's not just saying, look, there were a bunch of well-known wise people, and Shlomo was greater. The Midrash says, he was greater, he was smarter than Mikol HaAdam, meaning Adam. You're smarter than Adam.
Look, Adam wasn't that smart.
So the Midrash says, what's the wisdom of Adam? That he knew how to be Korei Shemot. Right, that when God told him to call names to everybody, he called names to everybody, including God. Right, the Midrash. First, he goes through.
He's so wise, but he still ate from the fruit that God told him not to eat.
Wise is not. Well, he not necessarily, you know, have self control.
He listened to his word.
So, you know, the Midrash identifies that his wisdom was that he called everything Shemot, meaning he could look at something and say, "I understand the nature of this," and gave it a name. I'm Adam because I'm Adama. And God said, "What's my name?" So he says, "Well, your name is Adonai because you're the Adon al Hakol." So the Midrash says he was smarter than Adam, meaning just like Adam was able to perceive the essence of something and give it a name, Shlomo understood the essence of things. Me'itana Mizrahi is Avraham. Heyman is Moshe, because he's Bechol Beiti Ne'emanu. V'chalkol, v'dardab, b'nei mechol, and then they identify each of these people, like classic people from Tanakh, he's smarter than all of them, in each of their own way. Vaydaber shloshet alafim mashal, he shiro chamishav aleph, and he composed. So now Rashi notes there's two ways of reading this: either 3,000 mishalim, and a mashal is just an educational parable like Aesop's fables, right? Or Rashi has another possibility that elef doesn't necessarily mean 1,000. In Aramaic, elef means a lesson, right? So it could be that this is a cognate, and it would be not 3,000, but it would be 3 units of Mishalim, like 3 lessons of Mishalim, because Mishle is divided into 3. There are 3 places in Mishle where it says, these are the Mishalim of Shlomo. So it could be that he had 3 units of Mishalim, but either way, he wrote... Correct. So according to Chazal, he writes those 3. So Mishle says 3 times that these are the Mishalim of Shlomo. And then his songs were 1,005. Now, this is also is interesting that music is considered one of the wisdoms, which is very classical. It's very, like, the Greeks believed this very much, that music was one of the, you know, the wisdoms, and now they've sort of come back to that in modern division of IQs and the like. Now, the truth is that the Greeks also believed that music and mathematics were linked. They understood that link, that it's based on math, and so, like, Pythagoras worshipped both math and music, right? He had a religion based on math and music and reincarnation. Sort of, it's a very interesting religion, but okay. I was listening to a shiur where they suggested, and this is, I actually like this, I don't know if it's pshat, but it's nice, that it's not just that he wrote songs, but that he had a intuition about how to provide tunes for words that actually said something, like that the tune helped you understand the words, right? That he really understood music and the effect that different moods could be brought out through the tunes and how that would affect the words. I don't know if that shot, but it would add to the wisdom of Shlomo. It also just drives me crazy when I listen to Jewish music. People, you can tell the difference between on the car ride to like, I already downloaded all these songs. I hate the Shrieky Boys and I hate it, but whatever. But I already downloaded it for the kids when we were driving. So I kept myself entertained. Yeah, so I kept myself entertained by listening which of the authors of the songs understood the words of the Pasuk that when they were writing it based on the tune that they were putting. There's some people you can tell it's a contemplative Pasuk or a sad Pasuk and they have a slow tune.
There was this Shimshon. Oh my God. Right.
I mean, that's crazy. You know, that's also, that was made as a vengeance song. He knew exactly what he was doing. He didn't not understand it. He did understand it, which is the problem. But like, I was listening to one song, which is Chizku V'imtzu on the Pasuk when Moshe tells Yoshua to, you know, which... Chizku, fine, but he includes the first half of the pasuk, which is, you know, that ani me'av esrim shana inu yachol atzeit v'lavo Hashem amar lo tavor in this upbeat tune. It's like he's saying I'm about to die and I can't, like, you know.
Yeah.
The rest of the song, fine, but you know, it didn't. So I like this notion that Shlomo, when he wrote music, he also gave thought to the connection between the melody and the words. Vaydaber al ha'itzim min ha'erez ashel b'manon v'ara'izo v'asher yotzei bakir vaydaber al ha'beimah v'ala'of v'alaremez v'aladagim. Now, there are these midrashic, you know, there's the famous midrash that he spoke to the trees and he spoke to the animals, but the simple pshat is that he was a zoologist and a botanist. He spoke about them, or in some of the mafarshim, it's not just that he knew about them, he knew their medicinal purposes, right? He knew which trees and which herbs could heal different things, but the simple read is that he knew zoology, he knew botany, he knew...
Maybe he had so many horses, maybe he was a horse whisperer.
Right, meaning not like a language, like he knew how to deal with them, he was a horse, an animal raiser, all that is pshat, you know, that he has all these wisdoms, that I'm totally okay with. The fact that he's, you know, the Midrash says maybe he spoke to animals, and then, you know, all these stories, people would come... You know, there would be a dispute about a tree. Who owns the tree? He would ask the tree, who do you belong to? Oh, I belong to him. And then he would paskin. And then, you know, but obviously the Midrash is playing on it. The simple pshat is he knows all these different things. Now, it could be a little bit even more than that. So Alex Israel suggests something very interesting on the next pasuk. He says, and everyone came to hear his wisdom from all the kings who heard about his wisdom. Now, he suggests that this is actually part of his wisdom. It's not just the result of his wisdom, but it's part of his wisdom. And he said, you think about the centers of learning in the world, you know, places like Harvard and Oxford and Cambridge, and they develop reputation as having smart people, and then smart people want to come. So he suggests that part of Shlomo's wisdom is that he set up a culture where people understood that wisdom was appreciated, so they sent all their wise people to learn from him, but while they were there, he learned from them, and he proves it from the next psukim. But he thinks that that's part of his wisdom. It's not only that Shlomo was clearly very, very smart, but part of it is that he knows how to harness wisdom and bring everything to Yerushalayim, and he proves it from the next unit, because one of the things he does is Vayishlach Hiram Melech Tzur Avadav El Shlomo Ki Shama Ki Oto Mashgul LeMelech Tachar Avihu Ki Ohev Ayach Hiram LeDavid Kol Yamim. So Hiram was the king of Tzur, of Tyre, and he sent his servants to Shlomo because he heard that he'd been made king, and he was friends with David his whole life. Vayishlach Shlomo El Hiram LeMar. So Shlomo says to Hiram, Ata Yadata Et David Avi Ki Lo Yachol Levnod By it, l'shem Adonai Elav, v'mnei al-melcham asher sevavu, atir Adonai otam, tachat kapot raglai. And this is the kriu k'tev here is very important, right? He says, you know David, he couldn't build a Beit HaMikdash because he had war. So he couldn't, you know, it wasn't calm yet. And he couldn't let him build a Beit HaMikdash until the enemies were given. So the kri is Raglai, because Shlomo is the ruler, but the Ktiv is Raglo, right? Because it wasn't under Raglo, it is under Raglai. It wasn't under David's control, it's under mine, and both of them make sense in context, right? It's not under...
It says Raglo.
Correct. It's a Kriuk div. It's read as Raglai, and it's written as Raglo.
Here it says Raglov. Kri is Raglov.
That's right. Here's Raglai. Okay, they may have changed the Gersa. This Basel JPS are not Meshubad always to the Misera. Like to the or
so
the
here it says it's Raglo with the Vav, and here they inserted the Yud, so it's Raglov.
Raglav and not Raglai? I think it is Raglai, though. I think in the traditional is Raglai. Kasuto might have actually... I don't know.
Kuf means Kri.
Kuf is Kri. Kuf is Kri and Chaf is Ktiv. So the classic one is to say that Raglo is the...
That's what's written, and here it says Kri Raglav.
Interesting. Okay. So here I have Raglai. But, and that, you know, that would make sense, right? That it's...
Because he didn't have any wars.
Shlomo unless it's a mistake here. Is it Raglav? I don't know.
No, but Shlomo did not have any wars.
Correct. No, that makes sense.
He finished everything.
Correct. And that's what he's telling him. He said, look, my father couldn't do it.
So Raglav makes sense.
Right. Both of them make sense. So Shlomo says, look, the simple shot is what, when Hashem says it to David, he says, I will allow you to build the Beit HaMikdash when there's peace. You don't have it yet, so instead I'll make you a dynasty, and your son will continue your dynasty, and the Beit HaMikdash will be called in your name. It's not yours, but it'll belong to your dynasty.
And please remind me, whose idea was to build the Beit HaMikdash? God's or David's?
No, David's. I mean, the Torah talks about a Beit HaMikdash, but
the
proximate...
Where does the Torah speak about the Beit HaMikdash?
Rasuli Mikdash. Mikdash. Well, part of it is to figure out... Okay. So, bracket it for a second. Is, right, the Mishkan... There's a Machlokas Rashi Ramban, whether the Mishkan was always part of the plan or it wasn't part of the plan, it only happened because of the Egel. The Mikdash seems to have been assumed, right? Because even before the Mishkan, right, the Mishkan, you only get a command from the Mishkan in Truma, right? In Perek Chafei, in Vayikra. But already in Mishpatim, you... Well, right, I mean, Mikdash is talking there about the Mishkan, but already in Perek Chav Gimel Pasuk Yudalit in Shmot in Parshas Mishpatim, you already have the assumption that there's a Mikdash, right? Because it talks about the Shalosh Regalim of coming to the Makom which God will choose three times a year. There's clearly a central, so it just seems to be assumed in the Torah even before Vasula Mikdash that there's going to be some sort of central place of worship. Correct. So, meaning there's some central worship of the Beit HaMikdash, right? Or in some capital. The details aren't fleshed out in the Chumash. So, David is the proximate cause. David says.
Why didn't they build it when they came in? There is also a reason why they had to wait so long until David came along.
Well, first they weren't settled, and then they had the.
Okay, you know, Sheva and Sheva.
Right, so the way Chazal say it is you need a king, right? You need a centralized government for a centralized worship for...
So the king was a condition for building the Beit HaMikdash.
Right, that's what Chazal say, right? You need a king first, then you need... The way Chazal say it in the Gemara and Sanhedrin, the second parak, is Shalosh Mitzvot Nitztavu Yisrael B'Knisatan La'aretz, Limnot Melech, Limchot Amalek, Vilvnot Beit HaMikdash, in that order. Right, first you need a central government, then you can get rid of your enemies, and once you've gotten rid of the enemies, and you have a king, so then you can build the Beit HaMikdash. And Chazal are obviously influenced by the fact that that's what happens, right? First you get Shaul, who kills at Amalek, is replaced by David. Once you create a dynasty and you settle the wars, then they build a Beit HaMikdash. And Hashem tells David, you could build the Beit HaMikdash, you're worthy of it, but you still have war, so instead I'll give you a dynasty.
Hashem told David that he should build the Beit HaMikdash, or he would be...
That his dynasty would, right? His son would.
That's what God told.
Right. Now, people misread that story, because the way the story goes is David said, I want to build the Beit HaMikdash. Natan says, good idea, go ahead. Natan goes to sleep, and Hashem says, what are you doing? Go back to David and tell him... Don't do it because there isn't peace yet. You can't build the Beit HaMikdash. Now, everyone reads it as Hashem saying to David, no. But that's not what he says. He says, not yet, which is a yes. Because David's reaction isn't, to cry and say, oh, I really wanted to build the Beit HaMikdash. It's he celebrates and he thanks God for promising him that he will have a dynasty that will build the Beit HaMikdash. I mean, David wants to build it himself, but his real goal is that his dynasty should be linked to Malchut Shamayim. So when Hashem says to him, look, it's not time yet, but don't worry, I promise I'll give you a dynasty, and your son will be responsible for building the Mikdash, David bursts into song. And now Shlomo is fulfilling that, and he turns to Hiram, and he says, you knew this, right? You knew exactly what was going on. You were friends with my father. So that's true. He says, Vata, now, there is this slight distinction that when Hiram sends messengers to David, he sends Sarav. And here he sends Avadav, which sounds like with David, you know, that's he's initiating diplomatic relationships, so he has to send higher ups, right? And, you know, he's only sending people to Shlomo because Shlomo is David's son. But so now Shlomo said, look, you had a relationship with my father, and now it's time, and there's nothing stopping me. So I mentioned this before. So I heard in one of the shiurim I was listening to, like while I was cleaning and, you know, the house and moving everything out of the house, just listening to things this morning and like, you know, so
officially still on vacation.
What? I'm not on vacation. No. When I was clearing out the house.
You have to work?
What? Yeah, I told Rachel Chino I'll be there. Yeah. We started last week. I told Rachel Chino I'll be down as soon as I've cleared out enough stuff so they can cut out the floor in my house. So, I was up. I gave the 6 o'clock daff because Rick Dropkin's away.
And
the 8:30. So I dove in at 6:30. Right. I gave the 6 o'clock daff, dove into 6:30, went home, worked out, showered, listened to a shiur, you know, gave the kids breakfast, went back to shul. Then came back home, cleared the house, whatever. So I got a lot of time to listen to things. So one suggestion was not just you need peace to build a Beit HaMikdash for a practical reason, but for an ideological reason, which is, especially in the ancient world, everyone had a temple to, I don't know, the god of war, to help them in war. If you're in the midst of war and suddenly you build a temple, there's always the concern that maybe either you'll actually say, well, maybe I'm building the Beit HaMikdash, I'll scratch God's back, so he'll scratch mine. Or it looks like it's Avodah Zarah-esque, right? You're building a temple to Ares that'll help you in war. If you wait till everything's peaceful, and then you do the Beit HaMikdash, like you wait, you already have everything. I'm wealthy, I'm smart, I have everything. And now you build a temple, it's clear, like I'm not doing it to... because I need God's help. God has already given me everything. I'm doing it because I recognize what I owe to God, which is nice. There's something, I think, something to that. So he says to him, "V'ata," and here's what Alexander points out. Instead of saying, so in Sur they were known for their woodwork because they had all these beautiful cedars in Lebanon, right? Tyre is like right up in the area. I'll explain where Tyre is in just a minute. But he said, "Vata tziva tzavei v'yechartu li arazim in Lebanon. Get me the trees, the cedars from Lebanon." V'avadai yu amavadecha. But he doesn't say, you know, do me a favor, send me workers. He said, "I'm going to send my workers with you to do the work." Now, why would he do that? So Rabbi Alex Israel points out, because if he's trying to build, you know, like the Advanced Institute, where all the wisdom in the world is comes to Yerushalayim, he's not going to say, "Oh, you're good at woodworking. You know, can you do me a favor and help me build a Beit HaMikdash?" He's going to say, "You're good at woodworking. Can I send my servants and they'll apprentice with you?" Right? So it seems like that it's not just that Shlomo is wise, he's actively pursuing wisdom, and that's part of why he becomes so impressive, because wisdom begets wisdom, and everyone's coming, so all the smart people are coming. And he says, "Uschar v'adecha yitain lecha kol asher tomar." I'll pay the workers. Ki ata yadat ki ein banu ish yodeh lechor deitzim katidonim, because no one's as good as cutting down the wood as you. It's clear, I mean, he's explicit. He's saying, I want my people to learn the skills from you. He's looking to advance the technology in Israel. Now, the interesting thing about Sur is that Sur is historically one of the most fascinating places in the world. It was a superpower beyond superpower, but not like a imperial superpower particularly. It was an island, and it had the best navy. So it just controlled the markets. So it was fabulously wealthy, and no one messed with Sur because they were extremely powerful, and you couldn't reach Sur to fight them. They just had these huge armies until Alexander the Great, in order to beat them, actually built a land bridge connecting Tsor to land. And then he was able to conquer Tsor. But it was...
Why? Is it in Lebanon?
What?
It's Tsor.
It's like right off...
Does it still exist?
I'm not sure exactly where it is. Do they have... I don't have my... And my atlas, I was going to get it, because I was, you know, this came up in three Shurim I was listening to. They all make this point. I assume they got it from somewhere, but I couldn't get to my atlas.mikra, which is now, which is now backed behind my, bookshelves. But, and it's clear.
Now, here, Tsor is not an island.
Well, not anymore. So apparently it was in the time of Alexander the Great. I don't know exactly where they got this from.
It's like, Sidon, Sidon.
Yeah, it's right. It's off. Yeah, it's like.
It's a shore. It's on the beach.
Yeah, it's like. So apparently there's a land bridge built to it. I'm not exactly sure where this came from, but I heard it in three different shurim. I didn't even get a chance to look at my atlas.mikra, because that's, sort of packed away now.
So in this map, it's not.
Right, well, they all claim that it once was. But whatever it is, it's this naval superpower. I have to take a look whether this is historically true. Now, this becomes disastrous for Shlomo. Well, for Klal Yisrael, really. For Shlomo, Tsor is going to be the nation which really, on the one hand, this looks really good for him. Like, he has this alliance with this economic superpower. But on the other hand, we're going to see in Perek Tet that it sounds here like, oh, Shlomo is in charge and Tsor is just helping him out. It becomes clear in Perek Tet that's not quite how it was, because Shlomo is paying an enormous amount of taxes, like tribute to him. It's not just paying his workers. And at some point he just runs out of enough money to do it, and he gives him 30 cities in the Galil as a present, in Perek Tet. So now some of the Mepharshim try to say, oh, no, they had a brit, and Shlomo gave him 30 cities, and he gave Shlomo 30 cities. It was, it was mutual trust. But a simple pshat is that he gave him 30 cities. Like, this may have started as some sort of friendly relationship, but Tsor was such a powerhouse that once you're in a relationship with Tsor, there's no getting out of a relationship with Tsor. And Hiram, in Perek Tet, it's not just he gave him 30 cities. Hiram goes to visit the cities and doesn't like them. It doesn't, Lo Matzachein Beinav, and he says to Shlomo, what are you giving me these cities for? He doesn't like go to war with him, but he expresses his disinterest and he names the cities based on the fact that he doesn't like them. So, right, it's clear that this develops, and it gets worse in Nevi'im Achronim, in Amos, I think it is, where Tsor eventually breaks the treaties with Klal Yisrael, and this is the in Amos's list of al shlosha pishei x val arba lo ashivenu. The first one is al shlosha pishei tsor val arba lo ashivenu. Right, you've sinned against me four times already. Right, there's been this rebellion, this distrust. So what starts off as a good relationship really devolves into not at all a good relationship. If I can find it quickly, but I was listening to, they have this 929 project, the Tesha Shtaim Tesha. So Benny Lau started a program like 2.5 years ago to have a nationwide Tanakh learning that would finish with a Siyum Tanakh on the 70th Yom Ha'atzmaut, so this year. So he got together, religious people, secular people, politicians, artists, musicians, everyone to give their own perspective on Prakim HaTanach. So, some people will give Torah, some people will give their political, and some people will paint pictures, and some people will write rap songs. And so you can go to their website, and each parak has this. So he has like a 15-minute shir on many Prakim and Tanach. He switches off with some people. He notes that this relationship with Tsor in modern sort of parshanut is a starting point for people when they think about do we want to get involved with superpowers or not, right? On the one hand, it starts off good. We start this relationship with a superpower that's really friendly to us, and we provide things for them, they provide things for us, but you never know where it's going to end. So he said, some people look at it, and he said, you find some religious Zionists who say, hey, this proves we should stop relying on America, we should stop relying on Russia, we should stop relying on anybody. And Benny Lau countered. He said, look, it may be true that it turned out badly, but on the other hand, it was necessary for the building of the Mikdash. I mean, you can't just say the message of the of Tanakh is you know, chad mashma'i, it's bad, or chad mashma'i, it's good. If you want to develop into a superpower, you have to develop treaties. Every treaty is dangerous because the power, the shifts in power. So he said he wouldn't look at this barak as a opposition because how was Shlomo supposed to build a Beit HaMikdash? He needed this treaty to get the Arzei Levanon, to build a Beit HaMikdash. You can't look at this in good faith and say the message of Tanakh is never enter treaties with superpowers. You also can't enter and say it's always a good thing. It's a mixed bag. Sometimes it's necessary if you want to be a superpower, but it can spin out of control, and that's just that's playing politics. You've just got to deal with that, which, you know, is a nice sort of modern commentary on what's going on with it.
You have to be vigilant.
Yeah, you know, and so this is, if you look, right, so it's Amos Perek Aleph. Sorry, it's not the first one. I take that back. But it is in the first parak, right? Kol Amar Adonai Al Shlosha Pishet Sor Val Arba Lo Ashivenu, because Al Haskirim Galut Shlomo Shleima Adom Velo Zachru Brit Achim. They remember the covenant of brothers. So therefore, Shalach Deish Bechomat Sor Vachlar Menotea, because they're eventually going to renege on this whole wonderful relationship. And again, how do you look at that? You know, is Hashem, when Hashem tells Amos to critique Tzor, that may mean, look, Shlomo wasn't wrong for entering into this covenant. It turned out badly, but that's a sin on Tzor's part. It wasn't that the Jews shouldn't have done it. It was just that Tzor, you know, didn't hold up to their end of the bargain. That happens. So he says, Vayikishmo Chiram and Devei Shlomo, Vayismach Maod. He hears what Shlomo said, and he rejoices. So, again, one of the suggestions I heard today, and this follows, you know, what Rabbi Israel had said, is that he doesn't just hear what he says. He hears the wisdom in, he hears the wisdom in how Shlomo requests from him, because he doesn't just say to Shlomo. He doesn't just say to Hiram, "Give me workers or give me wood." He says, "Let me apprentice with you." You know, and the fact that Shlomo's intuition was the, you know, teach me how to fish rather than give me fish, he hears that Shlomo is someone with a vision towards the future. And his reaction is, thank God that David is such a wise son. Not just smart, but he knows how to grow in wisdom. He's asking me to learn. I've heard what you really want, and I'll do it. Avadai, and you see how he responds. Avadai yoridu min alvon yama. Vaniyesem ein dovrot bayama. Makom asher tishlach elai. Vinipatzdem sham. Vatati sa. Vatata et chevtzi. Latit lechem beiti. Right? I'll send my people to here. You'll come up. You'll break them apart. Meaning, you want a partnership? Sure. This is how we're going to divide it up, and you'll pay the workers. Vahi Chiram natan leShlomo atzeras. And vazev roshim kol chevtzo. UShlomo natan leChiram esrim elaf gor chitim. We call it Makolit Leveto, Vesrim Korsham, and Katit, Ko Yitain Shlomo Lechiram, Shana Vishana, and he would give them this tremendous amount of food to Chiram. Vadrai Natan, Chokhmala Shlomo, Kasher Dibarlova, He Shalom, Ben Chiram, Ben Shlomo, Vechru Vichnehem, and Hashem had given him wisdom, and he promised him, and there was friendship between Chiram and Shlomo, and they made a treaty. So it sounds like Hashem gives his bracha to this, right? Meaning, this is a bracha, yes. And what's the connection between his wisdom and the treaty? Well, first of all, it's part of what makes the treaty successful, but also the way Shlomo develops the treaty is wise. He's trying to not just get material goods, but get wisdom that will help him. And then you hear the rest of the taxation, not just the monetary taxation, but the work taxation that Shlomo levies, and this is quite intense. Vayala melech Shlomo mas mikol Yisrael, vayhi amas 30,000 ish. He had 30,000 people in the worship, in the work of the government. Veshalchem levanona aser alafim b'chodesh chalifot chodesh yubal levanon shnayim chalishim veito v'adinoram alamas. And they would be in shifts of 10,000 every 3 months. Right, they spend a month working and 2 months at home. In addition to the 10,000 of people per month, so the 30,000 men he's sending up to Lebanon, he has 70,000 people porting, 80,000 quarriers in the hills, plus another 3,300 officials who were supervising it, plus the day workers who, you know, whoever they needed for it. So, you know, the taxes come, the money that we saw in the last parak, and
then this people.
Yeah, people. So it's, you see how heavy his taxation is. And he's bringing all these huge and valuable and heavy stones. And then, as Shlomo requested, the masons of Shlomo and Hiram work together. They shape it, and the timber and the stones, building for the Beit HaMikdash. So again, you see, you know, all of these, you know, you see on the one hand the good of Shlomo, his real wisdom, to bring wisdom in, to bring people, smart, you know, talent people into Israel, and use it for building the Beit HaMikdash, for creating treaties, right? Shlomo is clearly very successful that way. But again, as we've seen over and over with him, you see the beginning of the downfall, the tremendous taxation that it takes, the fact that he's starting to build these treaties with other nations, which at the moment are good, but can always turn awry, and the fact that he has so many kings, so much wealth, so many wives later on, which is, again, the violation of the rules of the king.
But God blessed him. The treaty seems, God seemed to be...
Correct, and that's the thing with Shlomo, is that nothing is... at this point, unambiguously bad. It all, there's the seeds of problems which will collapse. But anyway, so that's Chachmat Shlomo and the end of his sort of empire building.